and other managers also suggested that the Trump administration took the approach of no negotiation, blanket refusal, and no attempt to accommodate. That's also not true. In the October 8th letter that Mr. Cipollone sent to Speaker Pelosi, it said explicitly, quote, "If the committees wish to return to the regular order of oversight requests, we stand ready to engage in that process as we have in the past, in a manner consistent with well-established bipartisan constitutional protections and a respect for the separation of powers enshrined in the Constitution," end quote. It was Manager Schiff and his committees that did not want to engage in any accommodation process. We had said that we were willing to explore that. The House managers have also asserted a number of times, this came up on that first long night when we were here until 2 as well, that the Trump administration never asserted executive privilege. Never asserted executive privilege. And I explained at the time, that's technically true, but misleading. Misleading because the rationale on which the subpoenas were resisted never depended on an assertion of executive privilege. Each of the rationales that we have offered, and I'll go into the one of them today, that the House subpoenas were not authorized, does not depend on making that formal assertion of executive privilege. It's a different legal rationale. The subpoenas weren't authorized because there was no vote, or the subpoenas were to senior advisors to the president who are immune from congressional compulsion, or the subpoenas were forcing executive branch officials to testify without the presence of agency counsel, which is a separate legal infirmity, again supported by an opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. But let me turn to the specific issue of the invalidity of the subpoenas, because they weren't supported by a vote of the House authorizing Manager Schiff's committees to exercise the power of impeachment to issue compulsory process. Manager Jeffries said that there were no Supreme Court precedents suggesting such a requirement, and that every investigation into a presidential impeachment in history has begun without a vote from the House. And those statements simply aren't accurate. There is Supreme Court precedent explaining very clearly the principle that a committee of either House of Congress gets its authority only by a resolution from the parent body. United States versus Rumley and Watkins versus United States make this very clear. And it's common sense. The Constitution assigns the sole power of impeachment to the House of Representatives, to the House, not to any member, not to a subcommittee. And that authority can be delegated to a committee to use only by a vote of the House. It would be the same here in the Senate. The Senate has the sole power to try impeachments. But if there were no rules that had been adopted by the Senate, would you think that the majority leader himself could simply decide that he would have a committee receive evidence, handle that, submit a recommendation to the Senate, and that would be the way that the trial would occur without a vote from the Senate to give authority to that committee? I don't think so. It doesn't make sense. That's not the way the Constitution assigns that authority. And it's the same in the House. Here, there was no vote to authorize a committee to exercise the power of impeachment. And this law has been boiled down by the D.C. Circuit in Exxon Corp. versus FTC to explain it this way. To issue a valid subpoena, a committee or subcommittee must conform strictly to the resolution establishing its investigatory powers. There must be a resolution voted on by the parent body to give the committee that power. And the problem here is there is no standing rule. There was no standing authority giving Manager Schiff's committee the authority to use the power of impeachment to issue compulsory process. Rule 10 of the House discusses legislative authority. It doesn't mention impeachment. And that is why in every presidential impeachment in history, The House has initiated the inquiry by voting to give a committee the authority to pursue that inquiry. So contrary to what Manager Jeffries suggested, there has always been, in every presidential impeachment inquiry, a vote from the full House to authorize a committee. And that is the only way the inquiry begins. There were three different votes for the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson in January 1867, in March 1867, and in February 1868. For President Nixon, Chairman Rodino of the House Judiciary Committee explained there was a move to have him issue subpoenas after the Saturday night massacre, and they determined that they did not have that authority in the House Judiciary Committee without a vote from the House. And he determined, as he explained, that a resolution has always been passed by the House. It is a necessary step if we are to meet our obligations. There's been reference to investigatory activities starting in the House Judiciary Committee in the Nixon impeachment prior to the vote from the House. But all that the committee was doing was assembling publicly available information and information that had been gathered by other congressional committees. There was never an attempt to issue compulsory process until there had been a vote by the House to give the House Judiciary Committee that authority. Similarly, in the Clinton impeachment, there were two votes from the full House to give the House Judiciary Committee authority to proceed. First, a vote on a resolution 525 just to allow the committee to examine the independent counsel report and determine, make recommendations on how to proceed. Then a separate resolution, House Resolution 581, that gave the House Judiciary Committee subpoena authority. And at the time, in a House report, the House Judiciary Committee explained, I'm quoting, "Because the issue of impeachment is of such overwhelming importance, the committee decided that it must receive authorization from the full House before proceeding on any further course of action. Because impeachment is delegated solely to the House of Representatives by the Constitution, the full House of Representatives should be involved in critical decision-making regarding various stages of impeachment." Here, the House Democrats skipped over that step completely. What they had instead was simply a press conference from Speaker Pelosi announcing that she was directing committees to proceed with an impeachment inquiry against the President of the United States. And Speaker Pelosi didn't have the authority to delegate the power of the House to those committees on her own. So why does it matter? It matters because the Constitution places that authority in the House and ensures that there is a democratic check on the exercise of that authority, that there will have to be a vote by the full House before there can be a proceeding to start inquiring into impeaching the President of the United States. One of the things that the framers were most concerned about in impeachment was the potential for a partisan impeachment. A partisan impeachment that was being pushed merely by a faction. And a way to ensure a check on that is to require democratic accountability from the full House, to have a vote from the entire House before an inquiry can proceed. That didn't happen here. It was only after 5 weeks of hearings that the House decided to have a vote. And what that meant at the outset was that all of the subpoenas that were issued under the law, the Supreme Court cases I discussed, all of those subpoenas were invalid. And that is what the Trump administration pointed out specifically to the House. That was the reason for not responding to them. Because under long-settled precedent, there had to be a vote from the House to give authority. And the administration would not respond to subpoenas that were invalid. Now, the next point I'd like to touch on briefly has to do with due process. Because we've heard from the House managers that they offered the president due process at the House Judiciary Committee. And Manager Nadler described it as that he sent the president a letter, the president's counsel a letter, offering to allow the president to participate. And the president's counsel just refused, as if that was the only exchange. And it was just a blanket refusal to participate. But let me explain what actually happened. And I should note before I get into those details, there was a suggestion also that due process is not required in the House proceeding, that it's simply a privilege. But that wasn't the position that Manager Nadler has taken in the past. In 2016, he said, quote, "The power of impeachment is a solemn responsibility assigned to the House by the Constitution and to this committee by our peers. That responsibility demands a rigorous level of due process." And in the Clinton impeachment in 1998, he explained, "What does due process mean? It means, among other things, the right to confront the witnesses against you, to call your own witnesses, and to have the assistance of counsel." Now, I think we all know that all of those rights were denied to the president in the first two rounds of hearings, the first round of secret hearings in the basement bunker where Manager Schiff had three committees holding hearings, and then in a round of public hearings to take the testimony that had been screened in the basement bunker and have it in a public televised setting, which was totally unprecedented in any presidential impeachment inquiry, in both the Clinton and the Nixon inquiries. For every public hearing, the president was allowed to be present by counsel and cross-examine witnesses. But the House managers say that's all right because when we got to the third round of hearings, after people had testified twice, then we were going to allow the president to have some due process. But the way that played out was this. First, they scheduled a hearing for December 4th that was going to hear solely from law professors. And by the time they wanted the president to commit whether he would participate, it was unclear. They couldn't specify how many law professors or who the law professors were going to be. And the president's counsel wrote back and declined to participate in that. But at the same time, Manager Nadler had asked what other rights under the House Resolution 660, the rules governing the House inquiry, the president would like to exercise. And the president's counsel wrote back asking specific questions in order to be able to make an informed decision, and asked whether you intend to allow fact witnesses to be called, including the witnesses who had been requested by HPSC Ranking Member Nunez, whether you intend to allow members of the Judiciary Committee and the President's Counsel the right to cross-examine fact witnesses, and whether your Republican colleagues on the Judiciary Committee will be allowed to call witnesses of their choosing. And Manager Nadler didn't respond to that letter. There wasn't information provided. And we had discussions with the staff on the Judiciary Committee to try to find out what were the plans, what were the hearings going to be like. And the way the week played out, on December 4th, there was the hearing with the law professors, the first hearing before the Judiciary Committee. And on December 5th, the morning of December 5th, Speaker Pelosi announced the conclusion of the entire Judiciary Committee process because she announced that she was directing Chairman Nadler to draft articles of impeachment. So the conclusion of the whole process was already set. Then, after the close of business on the 5th, we learned from the staff that the committee had no plans other than a hearing on December 9th to hear from staffers who had prepared HPSC committee reports. They had no plans to have other hearings, no plans to hear from fact witnesses, no plans to do any factual investigation. So the president was given a choice of participating in a process that was going to already have the outcome determined. The speaker had already said articles of impeachment are going to be drafted, and where there were no plans to hear from any fact witnesses. That's not due process. And that's why the president declined to participate in that process, because the Judiciary Committee had already decided they were going to accept an ex parte record developed in managership's process, and there was no point in participating in that. So the idea that there was due process offered to the president is simply not accurate. The entire proceedings in the House, from the time of the September 4th press conference until the Judiciary Committee began marking up articles of impeachment on December 11th, lasted 78 days. It's the fastest investigatory process for a presidential impeachment in history. And for 71 days of that process, for 71 days of the hearings and the taking of deposition and hearing testimony, the president was completely locked out. He couldn't be represented by counsel. He couldn't cross-examine witnesses. He couldn't present evidence. He couldn't present witnesses for 71 of the 78 days. That's not due process. And it goes to a point that Mr. Cipollone raised earlier. Why would you have a process like that? What does that tell you about the process? As we've pointed out a couple of times, cross-examination in our legal system is regarded as the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth. It's essential. The Supreme Court has said in Goldberg versus Kelly, for any determination that's important, that requires determining facts, cross-examination has been one of the keys for due process. Why did they design a mechanism here where the president was locked out and denied the ability to cross-examine witnesses? It's because they weren't really interested in getting at the facts and the truth. They had a timetable to meet. They wanted to have impeachment done by Christmas, and that's what they were striving to do. Now, as a slight shift in gears, I want to touch on one last point before I yield to one of my colleagues, and that relates to the whistleblower. The whistleblower who we haven't heard that much about, who started all of this. The whistleblower, we know from a letter that the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community sent that he thought that the whistleblower had political bias. We don't know exactly what the political bias was, because the Inspector General testified in the House committees in an executive session, and that transcript is still secret. It wasn't transmitted up to the House Judiciary Committee. We haven't seen it. We don't know what's in it. We don't know what he was asked and what he revealed about the whistleblower. Now, you would think that before going forward with an impeachment proceeding against the President of the United States, that you would want to find out something about the complainant that had started all of it. Because motivations, bias, reasons for wanting to bring this complaint could be relevant. But there wasn't any inquiry into that. Recent reports, public reports, suggest that potentially the whistleblower was an intelligence community staffer who worked with then Vice President Biden on Ukraine matters, which, if true, would suggest an even greater reason for wanting to know about potential bias or motive for the whistleblower. And at first, when things started, it seemed like everyone agreed that we should hear from the whistleblower, including Manager Schiff. I think we have what he said.
But yes, we would love to talk directly with the whistleblower.
We'll get the unfiltered testimony of that whistleblower.
We don't need the whistleblower.
What changed? At first, Manager Schiff agreed we should hear the unfiltered testimony from the whistleblower. But then he changed his mind. And he suggested that it was because now we had the transcript. But the second clip there was from September 29th, which was 4 days after the transcript had been released. But there was something else that came into play. And that was something that Manager Schiff had said earlier when he was asked about whether he had spoken to the whistleblower.
We have not spoken directly with the whistleblower. We would like to.
And it turned out that that statement was not truthful. Around October 2nd or 3rd, it was exposed that Manager Schiff's staff, at least, had spoken with the whistleblower before the whistleblower filed the complaint and potentially had given some guidance, some sort, to the whistleblower. And after that point, it became critical to shut down any inquiry into the whistleblower. And during the House hearings, of course, Manager Schiff was in charge. He was chairing the hearings. And that creates a real problem from a due process perspective, from a search for truth perspective, because he was an interested fact witness at that point. He had a reason, since he had been caught out saying something that wasn't truthful about that contact. He had a reason to not want that inquiry. And it was he who ensured that there wasn't any inquiry into that. Now, this is relevant here, I think, because as you've heard from my colleagues, a lot of what we've heard over the past 23 hours, over the past 3 days, has been from Chairman Schiff. And he has been telling you things like, what's in President Trump's head? What's in President Zelensky's head? It's all his interpretation of the facts and the evidence, trying to pull inferences out of things. And there's another statement that Chairman Schiff made that I think we have on video.
But you admit it's a all you have right now is a circumstantial case.
Actually, no, Chuck. I can tell you that the case is more than that, and I can't go into the particulars, but there is more than circumstantial evidence now. So, again, I think...
So you have seen direct evidence of collusion?
I don't want to go into specifics, but I will say that there is evidence that is not circumstantial and is very much worthy of investigation.
So that was in March of 2017, when Chairman Schiff, as ranking member of HPSI, was telling the public, the American public, that he had more than circumstantial evidence through his position on HPSI that President Trump's campaign had colluded with Russia. Now, of course, the Mueller report, as Mr. Sekulow pointed out, after $32 million and over 500 search warrants, or roughly 500 search warrants, determined that there was no collusion, that that wasn't true. And we wanted to point these things out simply because for this reason. Chairman Schiff has made so much of the House's case about the credibility of interpretations that the House managers want to place on not hard evidence, but on inferences. They want to tell you what President Trump thought. They want to tell you, don't believe what Zelensky said, we can tell you what Zelensky actually thought. Don't believe what the other Ukrainians actually said about not being pressured, we can tell you what they actually thought. That it is very relevant to know whether the assessments of evidence he's presented in the past are accurate. And we would submit that they have not been, and that that is relevant for your consideration. With that, I will yield to my colleague, Mr. Cipollone.
So Pat Philbin steps aside, and we now hear Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, the man who began the presentation this morning.
Mr. Chief Justice,
and now resumes.
Members of the Senate, I have good news. Just a few more minutes from us today. But I want to point out a couple of points. Number one, just to follow up on what Mr. Philbin just told you. Do you know who else didn't show up in the Judiciary Committee to answer questions about his report in the way Ken Starr did in the Clinton impeachment? Ken Starr was subjected to cross-examination by the President's counsel. Do you know who didn't show up in the Judiciary Committee? Chairman Schiff. He did not show up. He did not give Chairman Nadler the respect of appearing before his committee and answering questions from his committee. He did send his staff, but why didn't he show up? Another good question you should think about. Now, they've come here today, and they basically said, let's cancel an election over a meeting with the Ukraine, And as my colleagues have shown, they failed to give you key facts about the meeting and lots of other evidence that they produced themselves. But let's talk about the meeting. They said it was all about an invitation to a meeting. If you look at the first transcript, the president said to President Zelensky, when you're settled in and ready, I'd like to invite you to the White House. We'll have a lot of things to talk about, but we're with you all the way. And President Zelensky said, well, thank you for the invitation. We accept the invitation and look forward to the visit. Thank you again. Then President Zelensky got a letter on May 29th, inviting him again to come to the White House. And then, going back to the transcript of the July 25th call, again a part of the call that they didn't talk to you about, President Trump said, whenever you would like to come to the White House, feel free to call. Give us a date, and we'll work that out. I look forward to seeing you. President Zelensky replied, thank you very much. I would be very happy to come and would be happy to meet with you personally and get to know you better. I'm looking forward to our meeting, and I also would like to invite you to visit Ukraine and come to the city of Kyiv, which is a beautiful city. We have a beautiful country which would welcome you. Then he said, on the other hand, I believe on September 1, we will be in Poland. And we can meet in Poland, hopefully. Now, they didn't read you that part of the transcript, and they didn't tell you what happened. A meeting in Poland was scheduled. President Trump was scheduled to go to Poland. He was scheduled to meet with President Zelensky. What happened? President Trump couldn't go to Poland. Why? Because there was a hurricane in the United States, and he thought it would be better for him to stay here to help deal with the hurricane. So the vice president went. Why didn't they tell you that? Why didn't they tell you that President Zelensky...
Pat Cipollone, presidential lawyer, White House lawyer, wrapping up the president's case for this day, he says. It's special coverage from NPR News.
And had to be canceled for a hurricane. Why? So that was our first question that we asked you. You heard a lot of facts that they didn't tell you. Facts that are critical. Facts that they know completely collapse their case on the facts. Now, you heard a lot from them. You're not going to hear facts from the president's lawyers. They're not going to talk to you about the facts. That's all we've done today. And ask yourself, given the facts you heard today that they didn't tell you, who doesn't want to talk about the facts? The American people paid a lot of money for those facts. They paid a lot of money for this investigation. And they didn't.
This is special coverage of the impeachment trial from NPR News, day one of the president's defense.
If they don't want to be fair to the president, at least out of respect for all of you, they should be fair to you. They should tell you these things. And when they don't tell you these things, it means something. So think about that. Impeachment shouldn't be a shell game. They should give you the facts. That's all we have for today. We ask you, out of respect, to think about whether what you've heard would really suggest to anybody anything other that would be completely irresponsible abuse of power to do what they're asking you to do. To stop an election, to interfere in an election, and to remove the President of the United States from the ballot? Let the people decide for themselves. That's what the founders wanted. That's what we should all want. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I look forward to seeing you on Monday.
The majority leader is recognized.
Mr. Chief Justice, I ask unanimous consent the trial adjourn until 1 p.m. Monday, January 27th, and that this order also constitute the adjournment of the Senate.
Without objection, so ordered, the Senate is adjourned.
And this is special coverage of the Senate impeachment trial from NPR News. We've heard just about exactly 2 hours of arguments as the president's defense team began laying out their case on this Saturday morning. They've said today was effectively the trailer, a preview of their full defense. I guess they've got 22 hours if they want to use them on Monday and Tuesday to continue that defense. Now, for the previous 3 days, we'd heard House managers, the prosecutors in this trial, presenting evidence that President Trump pressured Ukraine to investigate political rivals, effectively getting Ukraine or trying to get Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 election. We should note that the president's rhetorical style is often to accuse other people of whatever he's accused of, and one of his lawyers did that today, suggesting that Democrats are actually the ones trying to influence the 2020 election by removing the president from office and from the 2020 ballot.
They're asking you to tear up all of the ballots across this country on your own initiative. Take that decision away from the American people. And I don't think they spent 1 minute of their 24 hours talking to you about the consequences of that for our country. Not 1 minute.
Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, one of several lawyers for the president's side we have heard from today. Now, we're going to go through in the next several minutes some of the evidence that they laid out, some of their interpretations of the evidence, and also continue, as we have since the beginning, checking facts where that seems appropriate. The call on July 25 between President Trump and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky is a big part of this story. That call is at the center of the story, and a deputy White House counsel discussed it. This, of course, is the call in which the president did ask for a favor and went on later to request investigations of 2016 election conspiracy theories, as well as investigations of the son of a political rival, Joe Biden. White House lawyer Michael Purpura insisted, though, that the record of the call did not contain the other part of a quid pro quo, a threat against Ukraine.
The transcript shows that the president did not condition either security assistance or a meeting on anything. The paused security assistance funds aren't even mentioned on the call. Second, President Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials have repeatedly said that there was no quid pro quo and no pressure on them to review anything.
That's the way that Purpura put the case. Our correspondent Ryan Lucas has been covering this impeachment story for months and is here. Is anything left out of that account, Ryan?
Well, the White House team today was telling them, senators and the public, to focus very much on the call.
Mm-hmm.
But the call did not happen in a vacuum, and it's important to remember that. There was a campaign that began back in April, actually earlier than April, back in the first part of the year, stretching through to when this whole saga began in public in September, in which the president's agents, particularly Rudy Giuliani, his personal attorney, and we did not hear his name mentioned at all today,
mm-hmm.
were working behind the scenes to pressure the Ukrainian government to announce these investigations. And what the president's team was doing today was marshaling the facts that they feel are beneficial to their cause and leaving out those that are detrimental.
So if we were going to fact check that claim, we would call it true but incomplete, because in fact there was this withholding of military aid and there was sworn testimony from diplomats saying that they felt that there was a connection there and there were questions from Ukrainians. Tamara Keith, let me ask about something else that was said here. Jay Sekulow, the president's lawyer, noted that this is not the only time that aid has ever been withheld from a country. He gave an example of Pakistan, which was said not to be meeting its obligations, and the United States withheld military aid in that case. Is that identical to the Ukraine example?
It is not identical in that part of Ukraine being able to get this funding, it had to certify, the U.S. government had to certify that Ukraine was taking proper action on anti-corruption efforts. And it, in fact, was certified. That was certified by the Department of Defense before the funding was withheld. The certification happened, and then the idea was the funding would flow. Instead, the funding was blocked by President Trump, saying that it shouldn't flow. There was never a complete explanation of why that funding was held. There were a number of people who testified over the course of the impeachment proceeding in the previous months saying, yeah, we didn't know why it was being held. We were trying to figure out why it was being held. Top-level U.S. officials were trying to convince the president to release the funds. And then you had Mick Mulvaney, the president's chief of staff, at one point doing a public press conference saying, well, the funding was held because the president was concerned about corruption. The president doesn't like foreign aid mm-hmm. generally. And then he also linked it to wanting an investigation into the sort of conspiracy theory around Democratic campaign servers.
He said this was a quid pro quo to get Democrats investigated. And he said that on video, correct?
Yes. And then he walked it back very quickly. And all of the president's lawyers and the Justice Department and everyone was tripping all over themselves to say that they had nothing to do with what Mick Mulvaney had said.
OK, this is just a bit of what we've heard in these 2 hours of opening arguments today, cleaning up a little bit of the facts there. Let's now go to the Capitol, where our colleague Kelsey Snell has been watching and listening these proceedings this morning, as she has been for days now. Kelsey, good morning. Good afternoon in Washington anyway. What struck your ear as you listened to the arguments this morning?
You know, I think one of the things that that will be a theme that we're going to go back to over and over here is the conversation about the impact that the investigations will have on the election. I was struck by one of the White House attorneys saying that the argument is essentially let's cancel an election over a meeting with Ukraine. And Democrats have gone to great pains to try to argue that it is about ensuring that the next election is protected, not to cancel the previous election. And I'm hearing from a lot of Republicans. I get little notes from staff as these things wrap up. And they really feel that this argument about Republican staff really feels that this argument about the Democrats going after this president, that this president feels rightly attacked, is resonating with voters, Republican voters. So this seems to be something that we expect to hear over and over.
This is an argument on the Senate floor, but also a political statement. It's a statement that's being made to the television audience or the radio audience.
Well, we should always remember that this isn't just an argument to the senators on the floor. Yes, they are making this is a trial. They're making arguments to the jurors seated before them, but they are also speaking to voters. We saw a lot of that with Democrats, particularly in the primetime hours, trying to speak to voters about not only how they should feel about this impeachment trial and this president, but about the makeup of the Senate, because we should remember that there are a number of Republicans up for re-election in the Senate who are in vulnerable positions, places that Democrats are specifically trying to target and spaces where Republicans are trying to defend their majority. So this is about much more than simply what happened on a Ukraine call.
Let's fact check, see if our correspondents can help us here. One more thing before we go to a brief break. There was discussion of President Zelensky of Ukraine getting a meeting with President Trump. It was said that that meeting was withheld as part of this demand for investigations. The president's lawyers say, wait, there finally was a meeting between the two presidents on September 25. Anything we need to bring up about the timing of that meeting?
That meeting happened after the whistleblower complaint was out, after the story had blown up and was a very big deal. And the other thing that, and Democrats did point this out in their arguments, but Zelensky in that meeting, as I watched it unfold on TV, it was stunning to hear Zelensky go right to President Trump and say, this is great, but you know, it's funny, you just haven't seemed to schedule that Oval Office meeting you've been promising for the last 6 months.
Well, a subtle remark there, although Zelensky also has said, as the president's lawyers have pointed out, that he didn't feel any particular pressure in that July 25 phone call. So we are reviewing the president's defense, the president's lawyers' defense, which they began today in the last couple of hours. We're going to take a short break, go back to some of our local stations, and then continue with a bit more analysis. You're listening to special coverage of the Senate trial from NPR News.
You've been listening to special coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Senate impeachment trial of President Trump resumes at noon on Monday here on this station. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Good morning. The time now is just about 11 and a half minutes past 10 o'clock. No, yes, 11 o'clock, excuse me, this morning on this Saturday. I'm Ruth Ann Bessman, and yes, I'm it's going to take a while to get used to the fact that, yes, we were listening to interesting coverage, and it did take away Classics by Request this morning. Looking ahead for next week to feature your wonderful requests. And until now and then, I'll play some music that I hope you will enjoy. But before that, I want to remind you, in just about 47 minutes from now, we'll hear the Metropolitan Opera, the live opera. Today's opera will be a pre-recorded broadcast, though, of Puccini's La Bohème, and that begins at 12 o'clock sharp. And then following the opera, I will be back for a little over an hour of Saturday afternoon classics. Here's some music by Antonio Vivaldi for your listening enjoyment. It's one of his violin concertos. It's in A major, RV number 335. This performance is with violinist Shlomo Mintz conducting the Israel Chamber Orchestra.